In 1968, as part of the effort to end segregation, Congress passed the Fair Housing Act. Despite that, many of the country's cities remain effectively segregated. As part of a settlement in 2009, Westchester County is now required to build more affordable housing in Rye. But the county has been slow to comply with that settlement. And joining me now for a look at the Fair Housing Act and the situation in Westchester County are ProPublica reporter Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's written a series of articles called Living Apart, Fair Housing in America, Fred Freiberg, the executive director of the Fair Housing Justice Center, and Betsy Julian, a former assistant secretary for housing and urban development during the Clinton administration. She's now the president and executive director of the Inclusive Communities Project in Dallas, Texas, and she is joining us from Dallas. I'm very pleased to welcome all of you to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nicole, the story of the undermining of the Fair Housing Act begins almost immediately after the bill was signed into law. Wasn't it the most contentious piece of the civil rights legislation that was passed at that time?
It was certainly among the most contentious pieces of legislation. It was very, very vehemently opposed and went down in flames twice before it was eventually passed, and it really took the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, as well as the Kerner Commission report, which sought to look at the cause of about 2 years of rioting across the country, that finally got it passed.
So it was passed toward the end of the Johnson administration, and then Richard Nixon became president, and he was expected to carry on the policy. What happened?
Well, as listeners are probably aware, Richard Nixon was elected through a Southern strategy, which was taking kind of the disaffected Democrats and welcoming them in, Southern Democrats, and welcoming them into the Republican Party, as well as trying to appease ethnic whites in the northern suburbs. And so part of that strategy was to agree not to be too forceful on housing segregation or school segregation.
But didn't George Romney, Mitt's father, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development at the time, move aggressively to enforce the law? What happened?
He did. So George Romney was a staunch advocate of open housing and fair housing, and he believed that the federal government had a big role to play, in particular that it shouldn't be funding communities that blocked affordable housing. So he launched a program, kind of a stealth program under the radar that Richard Nixon was not aware of, where he began to withhold sewer dollars and other development dollars that HUD was giving to cities if they were blocking affordable housing. And when Nixon found out about this program, as he did when communities began to complain, he basically forced George Romney out of the administration.
Fred, HUD has spent billions of dollars since it was created in 1965. Has that money been used effectively in any cases in easing segregation?
Well, I think you have to look at the enormity of the problem, and the amount of resources sound like a lot of money, but given the fact that the better part of the 20th century, government and other entities played a significant role in segregating our communities based on race, it's going to take a lot of resources to undo it. So I don't think the resources have always been enough, and they haven't always been used wisely.
Well, since 1974,
the Fair Housing Law.
And since 1974, HUD has only withheld funding from communities twice on the grounds that they weren't complying with the Fair Housing Act. Were they particularly egregious cases?
There were cases in which HUD did condition the funding, other cases where they may have issued veiled threats that they were going to suspend funding. But you're correct in characterizing their role as less than aggressive on this issue. And you know, part of it is that HUD is a somewhat conflicted agency because on the one hand, they're charged with enforcing the Fair Housing Law. But on the other hand, they're charged with furthering housing and community development activities around the country. And sometimes those two goals conflict.
Well, in some cases, communities continue to receive funding even after they'd been sued by the Department of Justice or had the courts ruled that they were engaging in segregation policies.
That's correct. No, you're right.
So Betsy, you've worked in the government. Does one part of the government not talk to the other part of the government?
Oh, they talk, but I think Fred has identified from an internal standpoint one of the real practical reasons that the Fair Housing Act, this portion, and particularly the affirmatively furthering duty, has been so ineffectively not only enforced but complied with by HUD, and that is what I call the many-headed monster that HUD is. And it really has, all of its missions, I think, the people in those, whether you're building public housing, or you're helping communities grow, or you're fostering home ownership, you see those as missions as important and valuable. And so it's not like that it's just the fair housing is the only one that seems to have a moral imperative. Everybody feels like that they've got an important job to do there. The conflict is just inherent, and it's in everything. I mean, I have to I think Fred has identified that real problem. Yes, we talk to each other, but at the end of the day, the people who are talking about fair housing and affirmatively furthering fair housing and complying with civil rights laws, their voice tends to get more ignored than even yelled down. I mean, I had a few probably what I'd call yelling matches, but mostly it is I'm sorry, but we just can't do that. It's going to cause this problem with this program. It's going to cause this problem with this other constituency that HUD has, whether it be the mayors or the single-family housing industry or whoever, or the public housing industry. And at the end of the day, I think Roberta Achtenberg said it very well, fair housing's always on the losing end of that discussion, particularly if money and power are involved.
My guests are Betsy Julian, a former Assistant Secretary for Housing and Urban Development during the Clinton administration, Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's written a series of articles called Living Apart, Fair Housing in America, and Fred Freiberg, the Executive Director of the Fair Housing Justice Center. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Nicole, there's a rather vague phrase written into the bill that says that the federal government shall affirmatively further fair housing.
Yes.
What does that phrase mean?
Well, that's been part of the problem with enforcement is it is a vague phrase. But from what
that
we
sounds like that vague phrase in Board of Education, the major Supreme Court decision that allowed states to drag their feet in desegregating schools for a very long time.
That's right. What we can tell from the legislative record was that there was this understanding that the federal government had played a major role in causing the segregation that the Fair Housing Act was meant to dismantle. And so with that in mind, they were given an affirmative role in then dismantling that segregation that they created. And so what the provision says is that they are to affirmatively further all of the provisions of the law.
But that's as far as it spells it out.
But that's as far as it spells it out. And I interviewed former Vice President Walter Mondale, who was one of the co-signers of the act and one of the drafters. And his idea was that after the initial act was passed, they would then go back in and clarify and strengthen some of the provisions. But, of course, it didn't happen because Nixon became president.
Betsy, you ran the department that's in charge of enforcing the Fair Housing Act, called the Office of Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity, during the Clinton administration. Does that office have much power within the agency?
Not comparatively. I think, and I want to compliment Nicole and ProPublica's series. It's excellent and just gets it exactly right as far as I'm concerned. But that's one of the problems. It has historically not. It doesn't distribute money the way the others do. It is really, I won't say disfavored, and certainly I have to say during the Clinton administration, Secretary Cisneros was very supportive of when Assistant Secretary Achtenberg was there and when I was there, of what we were trying to do in principle and sometimes in practicality. But the truth is, FHEO, nobody would say it is anything but the weak link in the overall programmatic, hierarchy of the four big program areas.
Well, while you were at the agency, HUD released the first ever guidelines for municipalities receiving block grants. Why hadn't that been done before?
Well, to be honest with you, everybody agrees that was a very weak reg, but there had been nothing before that, and we were actually quite proud that we managed to get a regulation out of the building, giving some kind of lip service to more than lip service, hopefully, to the notion that there was something to this idea of affirmatively furthering. And at the time, though, there was resistance within the building from the beginning that it was going to be. They had been existing for how many years at that point, 25, 30 years, without having to do anything. They didn't want to have to fool with it. The agencies, other departments thought it would be burdensome. And so there was a real reluctance. But anyway, it did get out of the building, even in its somewhat weakened form. And somewhat like former Vice President Mondale's hope. I think we thought and hoped that it would come out. People would see what its what its strengths were, but why it needed more teeth, and then there would be an effort to strengthen it. There was, in fact, a manual that was very detailed that originally, I think, was going to be the reg itself, and it became just guidance. Later on in the second term, there was an effort to beef up that regulation defining affirmatively furthering, at least as it applies to recipients of federal funds, and that failed, and Nicole accounts for that in her accurately, I think.
Well, did,
her,
did the new guidelines mean that municipalities were now disclosing more about how the grants they were applying for would aim to reduce segregation?
Here was the rule, and I want to speak to this in a little bit more broad than just the issue of the grantees. But the theory behind the way the reg was developed in 94 was that essentially you'd say to a city or a community, look, if we're going to require that you actually hold the mirror up to yourself regarding your fair housing situation, the condition on the ground where you live, if you'll do that fairly, if you will bring all the stakeholders to the table and look at yourselves, analyze it honestly, and come up with a plan to address it, we're going to give you some latitude to do that. We're not going to prescribe exactly how you do it, but we are going to say you've got to do it, you've got to keep the records, and you've got to implement some action plans. People would say that one of the major failings of that was that they didn't require it didn't require HUD to approve those analysis of impediments. I would have to say honestly, though, that probably wasn't a big problem internally. And having litigated against HUD in most of my professional career, I knew that given HUD's resources to do this, all HUD would have done was give rubber stamps to most things that came in. So there was some thought that that this would give advocates at the local community level some leverage if the communities either didn't do them or didn't do them well, and that would create some enforcement opportunities. It didn't work out that way. There was much hope and much a lot of activity when the regulation was released trying to educate communities about what furthering meant at that point, what they might do it right, trying to be positive, not trying to go in with the threat of quote enforcement at that point. It lasted that enthusiasm lasted a very short period of time, and frankly the 94 elections happened, and at that point HUD was under attack by the Congress broadly. The fair housing people, fair housing mission was always not the popular one on Capitol Hill, and at that point I think it withered very quickly after it got out of the building.
Well, Fred,
the
Government Accountability Office has done a review of HUD since President Obama took office. Were civil rights advocates surprised when it found that HUD had almost no system for ensuring compliance with the Fair Housing Act?
I don't think any of us that have been involved the number of years that Betsy and I have been involved were particularly shocked by that finding.
No.
Well, is this an issue of lack of will or a lack of training?
It's clearly a lack of political will, but I do think you are correct in the sense that there is some uncharted territory. But I have to agree with Betsy. There certainly have been people in various times in the past few decades that have been very committed to fair housing and very talented individuals who wouldn't say that affirmatively fair housing is all that vague to them. But it then comes down to whether the institution as a whole will embrace that concept and actually implement it. And that's, I think, where there's some real problems.
The Obama administration has withheld funding from two communities for not meeting its civil rights obligations. And one of them is Westchester County. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we'll talk about what's happened in Westchester and other things with my guests, Fred Freiberg, the executive director of the Fair Housing Justice Center, Betsy Julian, former assistant secretary of housing and urban development during the Clinton administration, now the president and executive director of the Inclusive Communities Project in Dallas, Texas, and ProPublica reporter Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's written a series of articles called Living Apart, Fair Housing in America. Stay with us. We are back with ProPublica's Nicole Hannah-Jones. She wrote a series of articles called Living Apart, Fair Housing in America. Fred Freiberg, Executive Director of the Fair Housing Justice Center, and Betsy Julian, the former Assistant Secretary for Housing and Urban Development during the Clinton administration, now President and Executive Director of the Inclusive Communities Project in Dallas, Texas. Can we talk a bit about what's happened in Westchester? Nicole, the initial suit was brought under the False Claims Act, but it wasn't brought by HUD. Why did Craig Gurian, a lawyer at the Anti-Discrimination Center, think that there were grounds for this case under the law?
Okay, so HUD couldn't bring a False Claims Act because the False Claims Act is used to basically vindicate the federal government of fraud. And so Craig Gurian has been working in fair housing for a very long time and really has been, like a lot of advocates, frustrated that the federal government was not enforcing the affirmatively furthering provision of the law. So he looked at Westchester and saw that Westchester was getting a lot of money from the federal government but was still very segregated, and that its whitest and most affluent communities were systematically blocking affordable housing.
Fred, was anyone in the Bush administration interested in joining his suit against Westchester County?
No, and that
was 2006.
That's correct. No one was until the administrations changed, and then the Department of Justice and HUD intervened in the matter and began taking over in terms of the settlement.
But if I could add, the Obama administration only intervened after the judge had ruled on basically all of the aspects of the suit except for whether the county had knowingly committed fraud. But the judge had already ruled that the county had defrauded the government at that point.
So why do you think, and I'll ask you this, Betsy, as well, every administration since this law was passed, Republican and Democrat, seems to be pulled into these cases kicking and screaming instead of willingly? Isn't this the law of the land?
Well, it is, but the I often say the alchemy of race and housing has been a problem throughout our history. I agree with Nicole. It was the last major piece of civil rights legislation for recent, and as tragically as it sounds, I really don't think we may have ever had a Fair Housing Act without the assassination of Dr. King. So the lack of political will, Fred said it earlier, that is what it's all about. It is political. It's a bipartisan failure of political will. The Romney story is powerful because it points out that there were people with of moral courage who have been in high political positions who've tried. I think Secretary Cisneros falls in that category. But ultimately, the forces that blow back from Congress, from constituents, from the more powerful, have just made it not a politically viable thing in many political people's minds. And I say that, I realize I don't want to suggest there are reasons why the Fair Housing Act, and particularly this provision of the Fair Housing Act, has been so ineffectively, I'd rather say complied with, because HUD had to comply with the Fair Housing Act, not just enforce it. And it hasn't done that, and there are reasons for that, but there are no good excuses for it.
Westchester County had received $187 million in block grants from HUD since 1976. And the judge in the case, Denise Colt, pointed out in her ruling that the county had used the grants to, in effect, increase segregation. But many say that the stark difference in ethnic makeup in Westchester is due to differences in class, not race.
That's a common argument that you hear, and we wanted to address that kind of head on. So what we've done and what witnesses for Craig Gurian did was to actually look at census figures and determine if it actually was race or class. And when you look at where African Americans who have a certain degree of wealth live in the county, they're actually just as segregated from white residents as poor African Americans, and Latinos as well to a lesser degree. So,
are they denied the right to buy a house in an area that is predominantly white?
Well, there's been testing done in Westchester County, and it's found that about one out of five times African Americans and Latinos are treated differently when they're trying to seek housing in the county. So discrimination definitely plays a role.
Systemic discrimination is pervasive yet in the private housing market as well as among government agencies. An example we were involved in Westchester County involved the town of Yorktown, where we, through one of our investigations, discovered that here's a virtually all-white community, And with their federal Section 8 rent assistance program, they had a residency preference, so only white people were getting vouchers. There were many African-Americans and Latinos on the waiting list, but there is no possibility and no hope that they were going to actually receive that federal assistance. Now, there's an example of HUD not only failing to affirmatively further fair housing, but not even finding discrimination within one of its own assisted housing programs.
In the initial settlement, Westchester County agreed to spend $51.6 million to build 750 units of affordable housing. And under the terms of the agreement, enforcement and all further legal action against the county would be up to the federal government. Has HUD continued to press Westchester to comply with the settlement?
The second part of my investigation showed that what's been called the Battle of Westchester has kind of been anything but. Westchester has not complied with most of the key provisions of the settlement, yet HUD, 3 years later, almost halfway through, at this point, more than halfway through the settlement, has yet to take the county back to court and ask for contempt. They've gone to court, but not to seek contempt and compliance on the issues that's out of compliance.
Well, in 2009, Rob Astorino, who is the current Westchester County executive, campaigned against the deal, didn't he? And he unseated Andrew Spano, who had agreed with the settlement. What are his arguments against the settlement?
Well, Rob Astorino would tell you that he is complying with the settlement. He would say they're building the housing and that the aspects of the settlement that he isn't complying with, the county is going back to court on.
Well, Mr. Astorino has argued that the ruling is not in order to integrate because, in fact, the ruling doesn't include the word integration even once. Fred, are those arguments familiar to people who are working to integrate housing?
Yes, they are familiar to us, and I think his argument really is not is really a red herring. I think there's significant actions that the county could take to affirmatively further fair housing, not only producing the housing but ensuring non-discrimination by the various communities that are in Westchester County and within the private housing market. I keep coming back to that because I don't want to leave the private housing market out here, out of the discussion. There's still significant discrimination in rental housing, in sales housing. There is steering going on yet. And those practices, government has to take a more aggressive role in eliminating that discrimination. Just yesterday in Queens, our organization filed a lawsuit against owners of a 107-unit building in Sunnyside, Queens, for a pattern and practice of discrimination. And this is not an unusual or atypical practice. The more testing we do, the more incidents we find of African-Americans and Latinos actually being barred from housing. And the practices are very subtle, and only testing is really able to get at the more stealth and covert discrimination that's still out there.
And is dealing with that the responsibility of organizations like yours? Doesn't government play a role in going after those kinds of situations?
Well, and unfortunately, a lot of the discrimination that we find, we're having to take action to eliminate that discrimination. We've had some good fortune in the Southern District of New York. The U.S. Attorney's Office has played a more aggressive role with us, and we've had some opportunities to partner with them. But I think overall, nationally, you would not characterize the government as being particularly aggressive in enforcing the fair housing law.
A listener has written in. This is a little long, but I'll try to read it. Why does no one address one of the largest benefits of being able to live in a so-called good neighborhood? It's the excellent schools that are in boutique school districts like Bronxville, which abuts the city of Mount Vernon, Scarsdale, which is next to the city of White Plains, Rye next to Portchester, Edgemont next to Greenberg. Look at the differences in the amenities that each district has. The tiny Bronxville School District has a climbing wall and just raised millions of dollars in donations to rebuild its auditorium. Some of the items auctioned at their gala were vacations in private Jackson Hole condos and Caribbean homes. A countywide school district would offer better amenities for all students and would provide an opportunity to have specialized high schools, which would benefit all students. Unfortunately, this will never happen because of the effect it would have on property values.
I would say that absolutely the Fair Housing Act was never just about being able to get into a house. It was about having access to opportunities. What racial segregation has done is it's created segregated schools, it's created a system of have and have nots, and it's not just school amenities, it's how many parks do you have in your neighborhood, it's how many healthcare facilities, grocery stores. And so integration is designed to provide equal access to those opportunities opportunities that so many people provide. And I would just say that the reason that we've seen so little movement is you have to understand that this was, you know, our nation was brought into fair housing kicking and screaming. And this is the most intimate form of integration. We've had more integration in terms of other areas of our public life, but who you live next door to and who you send your children to school with is very intimate. And so we've seen a lot more resistance to that than other aspects of civil rights.
As part of the 2009 settlement, Westchester County agreed to build 18 units of affordable housing in Rye, which is a predominantly white city. Why have there been problems with the site that the county chose?
Well, the site is problematic for many reasons. I drove out to the site, and the first thing that you notice when you're getting off the highway is the street sign marker that points to Rye in the opposite direction of where the affordable housing units are. You have to head into Port Chester across two highways, basically into a tiny piece of land that was left over after the highways came through. It's 14 steps from Port Chester border. You can only access it through Port Chester. So it's Rye in name only. It's actually in every other way part of Port Chester, which was, you know, is highly Latino and African American and not included from the settlement.
Betsy, have we seen similar things in other places where compliance has been ordered?
Absolutely, and I guess as I listened to the discussion around Westchester, I wanted to make the point that the sad thing is that there's nothing unique about what's going on there. What the suit was brilliant, and the settlement was important, but the kind of resistance and the kind of treatment, the thing that Nicole just described, it's kind of like you want us to integrate. Well, we'll show you how we'll integrate, and that kind of behavior, frankly, I've seen it all over the country. And that is one of the reasons that this is not just, certainly not just about Westchester. Westchester was a clarion call for HUD. They panicked. It came at just the right time with the new administration coming in that suddenly was somebody who was going to really make them do this. But this is going to be a long, hard slog.
Well, does HUD have a lot to prove in how it handles this case?
I think it has a whole lot to prove in how it handles this case. And they know it. This case, as I say, it was their opportunity to either pick up this snake and deal with it, or let it, you know, continue to bite them and everybody else. But I don't know what. I'm not involved with HUD right now, but I will say there's nothing all that different about what's going on right now in terms of what's happening on the ground and that situation that Nicole just described in terms of fighting of this, even in the face of that kind of finding that the judge made and HUD's rhetoric about doing stuff, is the kind of thing that you will always find, and I'm engaged in litigation and have been for years, where that kind, once the court rules, then the hard part begins, which is how do you remedy this stuff, and that kind of behavior and resistance is part of the, it must be part of the manual that every community has when they try to resist integration, and or at least resist desegregation and providing the opportunities, Nicole was talking about, and I do want to make this point. The reason segregation is so particularly invidious in the terms of the harm, the violation of the law is certainly the big piece, but nobody has ever segregated people of color to give them the good stuff. They have always done it to limit opportunity and to deny opportunity, and that's the reason that it's so, that you're the person who wrote in really hit the nail on the head. It is important because it addresses this issue of denial of opportunity that segregation has always had at its heart.
Fred, Craig Gurian, who brought the initial suit, has tried to get the judge involved in enforcing the settlement agreement, but HUD has asked him not to.
Yes, I'm aware of that, and that's most unfortunate.
Now, another listener from New Jersey writes into our show page, how does the Fair Housing Act affect the New Jersey Mount Laurel decision or vice versa? I saw many issues with Mount Laurel-type social engineering in Illinois when I lived in Chicago. One North Shore town, Kenilworth, was out of compliance with offering low-income housing, and the problem was that it was a tiny town area-wise that was already fully developed. You would have to buy a $2 million house, knock it down, and then build affordable apartments. Sometimes these regs are just not executable.
Well,
Betsy?
I think most people who look at the issue broadly believe that any kind of real solution, particularly as you're talking about affordable housing being one of the major tools to promote more inclusive housing, is that regional housing markets are the reality. So if you have a particular place where you can't build up, then you have to look at how that dynamic of small communities, small, exclusive, excluding white communities operate in the broader regional market, and try to address it. So,
Nicole, do you want to get in on this?
I just want to address the term social engineering. I think that's a term that we hear a lot, and I think what people do not acknowledge is that these communities were created through social engineering. And so zoning practices that keep out certain types of housing and that inflate home prices in certain communities, all of these are aspects of social engineering, and actually the segregation that the Fair Housing Law was intended to combat was a result of social engineering from the federal government to the local government.
During the Depression.
Real estate eras, right, from, 1930s on to 1968 when the law was passed. So I think people think of social engineering as problematic when it comes to undoing the harm, but don't want to acknowledge the benefit of social engineering in creating these exclusive communities in the first place.
Fred,
that's
any
absolutely right.
Any final thoughts, Fred?
Well, I think we have a significant task ahead of us as a country. We've got to decide whether we're going to deal with these opportunity costs that are out there, whether we're going to move forward and actually create a more open and inclusive society filled with communities that offer opportunities to all people and don't discriminate on the basis of race. And that's going to take significant political will. I hate to keep going back to that, but I think that is the issue. And those of us that have been advocates for years are still pushing that agenda because it's critical. It has a lot to do with the costs that we incur as a nation and the opportunities and benefits that we'll have as a nation and the future of our people.
We have just seconds left, but you have any are you optimistic about the lawsuit that you mentioned earlier against the manager and the landlord of this 107-unit apartment building in Sunnyside, Queens?
Yes, and part of the reason is that our testing program is run very well, and we gather evidence. It's very strong evidence. You can see from the facts and the complaint that have been in the paper and so forth. So I do think we'll have some success in opening up that housing and ensuring non-discrimination in the future, as we have with many other cases.
Nicole Hannah Jones and Betsy Julian will be taking part in a panel discussion this Monday about whether the government should compel communities to integrate. That's at 6:30 at the Tenement Museum at 103 Orchard Street. For more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. And on our show page, you'll also find a link to Nicole's series. Thank you all so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.